Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And we're going to talk today about end of year movies, which is always a big scramble to get things in there so that they'll be eligible for the Academy Awards. We're going to start off with Spider-Man, No Way Home, the third, and actually, I don't think it is the third. It's the third with this director, but there's been several Spider-Man movies, and this one is the latest one to come out. And in this one, Peter Parker's identity has been revealed, and he has been framed for a murder. So he is on the run, goes to meet Doctor Strange to cast a spell to make everyone forget who he is. But while he's casting this spell, Peter Parker keeps adding, oh, but don't forget, I don't want this to happen. And don't forget, I don't make this happen. So the spell is flawed. And then mayhem, of course, ensues. So Mike, let's start off with, how did you like this movie?
Marie, I really love that expression, mayhem ensues. It has a sort of Victorian melodramatic quality to it. And actually, in terms of the film itself, I was pleasantly surprised. I liked it more than I expected to for a few reasons. Even though I had mixed feelings about the film, one thing I liked was the strong narrative hook. You have Peter Parker's secret identity revealed. And of course, at that point, you know, he becomes a global celebrity, certainly through social media. And what's fascinating from an almost sociological standpoint, if you will, is how people respond. And at high school, which is what really counts, some people see him as a hero, other people more as a villain, indeed, even maybe a criminal. And that's a strong point in the film. Secondly, I think Tom Holland's performance is quite good. He's a really youthful and vigorous Peter Parker. He's very convincing in the role. And he's had, you know, of course, other actors take that role before him. On the downside, the deficit side, the film, and this is something I say again and again about Marvel movies, it has a running time of 2.5 hours, which again, it's just too much. And what was a good premise, a good narrative hook, really goes slack after a while. You can only milk that. You can only work with that basic situation so much. And I think the film does kind of bog down with that. And it could be a lot tighter.
I agree with you. I'm always discouraged even going into, especially a Marvel movie that clocks in over 2 hours, because you know you have to stay till the bitter end to get that last Easter egg. So you know you're in there for, you know, 3 hours, which is a long time to ask people to sit. That being said, this was a fun movie to watch. The time really did seem to fly by for me. I will say, Mike, I like Marvel movies more than you do. And I, of all of the Marvel characters, Spider-Man is my favorite one. So I went into it, you know, with some preconceived ideas of what I was looking for, and it delivered. And that's mostly the, like you said, the narrative is quite compelling. It gives you, especially if you've hung in there through all the other Spider-Man movies, a real sense for what Peter Parker's fame does to the people around him, his friends, his aunt, people that he cares about. It's not just what happens to him, whether he's notorious or, you know, on the run. It's how that really affects everyone around him. And when he decides to try to, you know, maybe I should just let Dr. Strange's magic work the way he wanted it to, which is everyone would forget about who he was. You have to start all over again. You have to try to meet those same friends that you remember and try to reestablish those connections. So it gives you sort of more of the idea of, you know, the business of being Spider-Man, the things that go on that you wouldn't necessarily think about when it's all about heroics. You know, what is it like to personally be Spider-Man? It's also great to see all the characters that you like reappear. It's wonderful to see all those villains come back, and you get all three Spider-Men. I know that's not really a spoiler because it's been all over the internet forever. You get to see all three Spider-Mans at once because of the spell's quirk that alternate universes are colliding. So it's fun to see all three of the Spider-Men in there. It's fun to see Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire and Tom Holland all with their different iterations of Spider-Man. So for Spider-Man fans, I think it was a real high watermark. Now, when I saw it, Mike, there was only about 7 people in a really big theater, and it was in 3D, which I really like, which was, I think, probably everybody felt pretty comfortable given that there was enough social distancing and that it was, you know, a movie you wanted to see in the theater. How well attended was it when you went?
I had a very different experience. When I saw it at the Senator Theater, which seats almost 900 people, the theater was crowded, and it was a really appreciative audience. And whenever these characters from the past, if you will, and this is a cynical observation on my part, the real fan base would not share this cynical observation, but when you're in the Spider-Man multiverse, as they call it, you can do anything, and Marvel loves that, right? You can bring back any number of actors, characters, situations, whatever, press the button, and you've brought that back into the play. And when you've brought it back into play, when it's back in the picture like that, I love the audience reaction, actually, because as various people popped up from the past, whether previous Spider-Men or others, there was an audible response from the audience. There was applause. People were laughing and applauding. And I thought, I was like an anthropologist observing this, right? I thought, this is fascinating behavior. And so Marvel, to its credit, knows how to milk the franchise or develop the franchise, however you want to phrase that. And so it was a boisterous response. And when I saw the size of the crowd, it was the biggest theater crowd I'd seen in months and months and months. I was not then surprised late last year to then, you know, track it and realize that Spider-Man is the box office champion for 2021, far and away. And in fact, it's going to be one of the highest grossing pictures of all time. I mean, as we speak, it's still accruing income. And so the elements that work there work really well. And it goes beyond the fan base. Even I, you know, as grouchy as I can be with Marvel movies, even I found myself enjoying it. I was a little reluctant to admit that, but even I was enjoying it most of the way through. Maria, let me ask you what might be an obvious question, but I think it's worth spelling out. When you said earlier, of all the Marvel franchise films, that Spider-Man is your favorite in terms of the main characters. Why don't you elaborate on that a bit as to, of all of them, why he really, for you, means the most, you care the most, basically, about Spider-Man?
Well, I'm embarrassed to say that my reasons are completely shallow. I mean, I like the fact that he's got a really nice red costume. That's first of all. The other part is that, you know, before I was faculty at HCC, I was the webmaster at HCC. So anything having to do with webs and spiders, by the way, spiders creep me out. But there's something about that being the source of his power that I find interesting, just for those two non-serious sounding reasons. But I've just always been drawn to that character for that reason. I have all with you though, Mike. I mean, we've talked about how long can this franchise milk this idea that, you know, then now we're going to pick up this character and I'm going to go back to that character. How many movies before you exhaust your audience's patience with and yet another installment? So I will say this about the Spider-Man movies specifically, that I'm teaching a winter session class, Intro to American Cinema. And, you know, we start off by introducing ourselves. And a lot of the students talked about how they hadn't been going back to the theater since COVID. But the one movie they were willing to go back and see was Spider-Man. And I think that's because of what I said. You know what to expect. You know there's going to be wonderful CGI and really believable flying sequences. And that's what you go to see. And by the way, in 3D, really, really fun. I think everybody felt like they were actually flying with him. Maybe that's another reason. There's something more exhilarating about flying through the air like Spider-Man than some of the superpowers. It's fun to watch Doctor Strange, for example. I love Benedict Cumberbatch, you know, casting spells. But that's just not as exciting, I think, cinematically as flying through the air like Spider-Man.
If I could, in fact, demographically, I noted the same thing with the theater audience I watched it with. There were large groups of young adults, college age adults, people were going with their friends. It was a social outing. And many of these people probably had not been going to theaters much otherwise, but Spider-Man got them out. And so you're absolutely right about that. Adding to your list or roster of reasons to like him as a character is, it is fun just simply to watch somebody fly through the air, but it's not so extreme as flying goes. You know what I'm getting at? It's not like somehow supersonic or out into outer space, whatever. It's manageable. It's like from this building to that street, whatever. And you feel like there's a human scale to it. And in that respect, there's a vulnerability to the character of Peter Parker. I mean, essentially, you know, as a surrogate for all of us, like put yourself back in high school, put yourself back in that teenage age. And when you think about what it was like being a teenager, just the usual pressures and tensions and worries and all. And now, my gosh, what if you have this also to worry about? The vulnerability there of, you know, who will know his secret? How will they respond once it's revealed? All that taps into what would otherwise just be the regular or the routine teenaged worries, right? And now you've got this immense one of, you know, you're a global celebrity as Spider-Man. And that kind of, I call it vulnerability, because there's a sense of his sensitivity and his vulnerability. And I think that tends to make audiences really identify with him in a way, which works quite well, I think, for the character. Now, part of the challenge will be what Marie says. Once you start getting Doctor Strange with all these magic spells and this and that, how much can you milk that? I think that's a valid worry. And it's nice to bring back old characters, at least for the fan base particularly, but to what extent can you keep doing that? I think you can reach the point of diminishing returns. And I think this could be a factor, actually. You know, to what extent will Peter Parker age? Will he grow up, basically, as the series goes on? I mean, you can empathize with him as a teenager. Once he becomes a young adult or pushes into early middle age, what would it be like at that point? And I'm only being partially facetious. Once the actor gets to a certain age or station, what do you do with the story at that point? Does he start to worry about, you know, his retirement plan, you know, his mortgage? I mean, where does that put Peter Parker at that point? What do you think of that? Because I think this is obviously a series that has a based on the box office smash results, we're going to see a lot more of the Spider-Man movies. But, you know, even though Tom Holland's a good actor, you know, he's getting into young adulthood. And what do you do at the point where he's reached a certain plateau? And his secret, you know, the Spider-Man secret is known to everyone else in the film. Where do you go from there with it? You know, once you play out the ramifications of the secret unveiled.
I think you can probably get one more movie out of it where he marries MJ and they have a baby and they don't know if the baby's going to have superpowers or not. That's the logical sequel. But you're right. It's going to be very difficult for, you know, middle-aged actors to, you know, play a guy who's, you know, part of the PTA, but, you know, in his spare time. He fights crime and swings from building to building. But by the way, I wanted to ask you real quick whether you thought the fun of watching Spider-Man do what he does is reminiscent of Tarzan and the Jungle Book, where you're swinging through the trees, except it's, you know, it's an urban jungle instead.
It's a really wonderful analogy you draw there. It's no different, essentially, than kids going to the movies in the 1930s on a Saturday afternoon and watching Tarzan swing through the jungle. It's the same sort of primal thrill to watch that. And again, there's definitely a vicarious enjoyment just simply watching him swing through the trees like that. It could be Tarzan swinging through the trees in a, you know, a Saturday afternoon serial in the 1930s. The kid in us just enjoys watching that. It's just fun to watch that. And again, the fun is diminished for me when it's, you know, pushing into, you know, the second and third hour of the film. And I think, again, I keep reiterating this point that if only it were tighter, it would be even more enjoyable.
Now, I think for Academy Awards consideration, definitely some special effects kinds of nominations. Anything else? I mean, given that it's such a box office favorite, any chance it'll be a contender for Best Picture or any directing or anything? I don't want to say more prestigious, but I mean, you know what I mean, the top of the ticket items in at the Oscars.
No, Marie, it's a really good question because the superhero movies, I'll just generically call them that, they're always going to get a lot of nominations in technical categories. That's just a given. Where it's problematic sometimes is when you start to get to top of the ticket items, best director, actor, and so on. This is a film, though, because it's by far the biggest box office film of 2021, it's going to get a Best Picture nomination. It'll probably pick up some others. I mean, Tom Holland's quite good in the role. I wouldn't be surprised if he gets a Best Actor nomination there. So I think it probably will get some more top of the ticket nominations than some of the other superhero movies because it just simply can't be denied. It's so popular. Whether it wins or not is another matter, but I think it'll at least get the nominations.
I think given that we both mentioned first off that we liked the story, maybe a screenplay nod too. So the one thing I wanted to tell people to look for is that MJ works in a restaurant called Peter Pan Donut and Pastry Shop. It shows in the opening and closing of the movie. This is a real place in Brooklyn, but the movie was shot in Georgia. So the production company visited the real location, photographed it, and built a reproduction for the shoot. The real staff of the real Peter Pan is thrilled that they are now part of the Marvel universe. So always kind of fun. In case you are in Brooklyn, you can go check out the restaurant and feel like you walk right into the movie set.
On a pragmatic note, because of tax breaks and other incentives, you know, Georgia, of course, is where so many movies are being shot. And for me, it sort of brings everything down to earth. You can have a movie set in outer space or in some fantasy world, and you read the end credits and you'll see that Georgia peach and you realize how much of it they were able to shoot in Georgia. So it is, after all, the movie business, right? And so there are reasons why, you know, shooting in Georgia makes a lot of financial sense. Takes away some of the thrill of thinking this is actually being shot way out where, but no, it's in Georgia, and that's because the state legislature has given all these tax incentives.
All right, so now we're going to talk about a movie called Come On, Come On, which, you know, the lead in for this, I will say, in terms of my students, is that they're all such huge, huge fans of Joaquin Phoenix in Joker. And, you know, Joaquin Phoenix has sort of made it his stock in trade to do these quirky guy roles. Absolutely love him in the movie Her for this very reason, this sort of, you know, oddball. He's really good at playing the oddball. Well, he's playing against type here, where he plays a guy whose sister is, I guess, currently married. I don't know if they're estranged, but her husband is having mental issues, and she needs to try to get him into some sort of facility that will help him. And she's got a son that she asks her brother to look after while she's dealing with what she thinks is going to be, you know, a couple of days, which of course turns out to be more. So this is, we've seen this setup before, where a person with no exposure to children ends up being a caretaker for one, and a lot of the storyline comes from the fish out of water story, you know, not knowing what to do in this situation. It's also about Joaquin Phoenix's character, who I guess he's a radio guy, and he goes around interviewing people about various topics for his show. So let's start off with Joaquin Phoenix, Mike, in terms of him playing a guy with a radio show. What would that be like, Mike? And how he ends up with this kid, and what transpires?
Well, one thing about him as an actor actually is his versatility. When you think about the roles he's played, you mentioned Joker, and that's where, you know, certainly my students and many people I know would immediately think of that in terms of his screen career. But then you think of Her, and of course, we use that film in courses we teach, so we do talk about him in that respect academically. Also, the film Walk the Line. You realize that this is an actor with considerable range. In this film, he's really, really playing someone who is a committed professional. By that, I mean he's a radio journalist and sort of an NPR type journalist, and he's doing documentaries that take him around the country. He's professional also, of course, in the sense that he's so devoted to this, he doesn't have that much of a personal life, if you will. He's not really romantically linked up, whatever. And ironically, he's working on a documentary about children. So he's interviewing, you know, non-professional actors, if you will, actual kids, and asking them basic existential questions. And the irony, of course, is how this is going to come full circle when in his own life, his character, you know, has a sister that Marie's described. And you know, this sister is really beleaguered because she needs someone to look after her 9-year-old kid while she tends to her ailing husband. And so the setup really is a setup for a character study. And that's one nice thing about the film is that, you know, if Spider-Man's a big picture, which in its own way is a character study, certainly Come On, Come On is a much smaller picture, more tightly focused as a character study. This might be the place to mention that the director of the film, Mike Mills, is known for character studies. Think about Christopher Plummer in Beginners. Think about Annette Bening in 20th Century Women. You think about films that are very kind of deliberate and leisurely in some ways, but stay tightly focused on just one or several characters. That's a real plus here. For me, the minus is that even though the actors are all quite good in this and the characters are interesting, it sort of plateaus. By that, I mean it reaches a situation of the uncle caring for the kid, learning to bond, learning parenting skills, and so on. Where it starts to plateau or actually lose steam, where I'm concerned, is that the characters are relatively shallow. They don't get developed beyond a certain point. Secondly, it's nice spending all that quality time with uncle and nephew, if you will, but the sister and her husband, her partner, they are really kind of shadowy characters sometimes. They don't get a lot of screen time or depth, and I want to know more about them. I want to spend, particularly the sister, I want to spend more time with that character, if you will. And so for me, that's an issue. And for me, at least a third reason why the film kind of loses steam is the character itself that Joaquin Phoenix is playing. Understandably, he doesn't have the experience of raising a kid, but the degree of naivete that this character is given to me seems extreme, because as a professional journalist making a documentary about children, another irony, you would think at least in a kind of detached, you know, almost quasi-academic way, he'd know a bit about the issues and the questions revolving around kids. But he seems so clueless at times that it seems like forced. It seems like it's pushing it thematically in that direction in a way that's almost implausible that he would be so naive or just so unsure of himself in certain ways. And there is a kind of sentimentality that kicks in, and that's okay. It's warranted, but it's kind of drawn out. It's kind of extended in a way where the film, for me, starts to lose momentum at a certain point. So I ended up having very mixed feelings about it, but essentially it's well worth watching. It is what they call a heartwarming story. And I'm only partly smiling there because it really is. It really does affect you in terms of, you know, the uncle bonding with the nephew.
Well, I agree with everything that you said there. You know, Mike, I think what this movie really needed was more of a lighter touch I felt that the it was almost oppressive the way it was nothing but bad news. I mean, first you feel, like you say, for Gabby Hoffman's character, and she's terrific in this, having to deal with, you know, her partner's mental illness. You also get a sense, without them discussing it, sort of obliquely referred to, that the kid is sort of aware that, you know, maybe I've got mental illness. How much hope do I have? You know, what's going to happen to my dad? All these scary things that, you know, have I been abandoned by my mother? All of these things that go through a kid's mind. And the child actor in this is absolutely phenomenal. Woody Norman, who plays Jesse. By the way, he's actually British, so he's doing an accent the entire time. It's just amazing. His character, though, is so insufferable, but very realistically portrayed. Lots of kids act like this. He's really quite phenomenal, but you lose sympathy with him after a while when he pulls the same kind of antics. You just want something more from Joaquin Phoenix than simply, you know, put that screen down and just sort of like mild things that he's learning about the kid. The kid, of course, is getting, because all they do is walk and talk. He's getting a sense for what it would be like to actually have a father figure. That comes across loud and clear. The whole movie, by the way, was shot in sequence, and it's all in black and white, except for, I think, one color scene at the end. So it has this sort of documentary feel, which again gives it this heaviness. Everything is so deadly serious, and they are dealing with serious topics. But I think it would have benefited from more of a few more lighthearted moments between Joaquin Phoenix and his nephew.
That's really an excellent point, because thematically it is heavy-handed. It gets drawn out. It's just so drawn out in terms of the two of them bonding and all the heavy duty issues. For instance, the questions that he asks in the radio documentary he's making, these are the big existential meaning of life questions. And the film can only really accommodate so much of that before it just starts to drag. It just seems like enough already. Give me some levity. Give me something that would lighten it a bit. And the second, or another really good point you make is, the kid, understandably, kids can be vexing and a handful, as they say, and all that. But this kid has some habits, like of disappearing. You're on a crowded street and, you know, in a big city like New York, and suddenly the kid thinks it's like either funny or just somehow the thing to do is like totally disappear. And the panic, of course, that the uncle has. Whatever sympathy we have for the kid, even if it's understandable in terms of childhood pranks, it really dissipates, doesn't it, Marie? You get to the point where you just think, oh my goodness, this film is so heavy and so relentless with this, and we should like the kid more than we do. And it's terrible to say that out loud, but Marie, isn't that what we're getting at? That there are places where he's like borderline unsympathetic.
He also has this game he likes to play where he's an orphan, which in the beginning is sort of, you know, played off as, you know, kids make up all kinds of things, but he insists on his uncle playing with him. And at first he resists. And I was disappointed in the end when he gave in and played that game with him, although it was the way to set up the way he could ask him about his mom and have the kid talk about his mom in the abstract as if it wasn't his actual mother. I mean, I saw what they were doing there in terms of the storyline, but it really kind of creeped me out. Mike, what was your reaction?
We were both creeped out by it. That's why, even though I wanted to like this film in terms of the caliber of the acting and just the essential narrative of it, by about the midpoint, I was losing sympathy with it. I just didn't, and it just kept dragging. It's not a long film, but it felt like it was dragging on at that point. And even though I love black and white films, the fact that it was black and white did lend to or add to that sense of self-seriousness. You know what I'm getting at? That this is like a somber situation. We're going to do it in austere black and white. And again, I love black and white inherently. I love black and white films, but I'm wondering why shoot this in black and white? I mean, there was no like overwhelming reason for that, was there? What'd you make of that? Because I thought I couldn't think of like the absolute reason why they should, other than to add to an already heavy look, an already somber look.
I think it just underscores this whole idea of ideas being strictly black and white, which I think, again, that just feels very heavy-handed. I didn't see a reason for it other than to give it that sort of documentary feel where, you know, when they're filming, but even when you're filming, you wouldn't necessarily film in black and white anymore. Just because you're interviewing people about, you know, how do you feel about after Katrina, doesn't mean it has to be in black and white to make your audience get that it's supposed to be serious. Now, there is a moment in the film where the kid is talking basically about how pointless it is to have conversations, real conversations with people, because everything's just blah, 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 blah. And the blah, 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 blah thing that they come back to it a couple of times. That was another thing that sort of was, I found, off-putting, that it sets up all of these big ideas and these big thoughts and everybody talking, only to dismiss it with this blah, blah, blah thing. What do you think, Mike?
Well, Marie, you make an excellent point. And I was trying to count all the blah, blah, blahs, and I lost count after a while. But some of the questions he asked, like one of the questions is, when you think about the future, how do you imagine it will be? I mean, this is the radio journalist asking real kids, you know, real questions, big existential questions. And another one of the big questions that he'll ask is, you know, what makes you happy? And so the film is essentially superficial because it asks those big questions. And then it's like, well, I'm waiting for the answer. And I know maybe it's unrealistic on my part to expect somehow these will be answered. But the film does an adequate job of setting up the big existential questions. And then to me, it seems like it, not that exactly chickens out, but it just kind of coasts on the questions themselves and then sort of coasts towards its resolution. And to me, it seems not quite that that's cheating, but simply that if the film's going to be so heavy-handed and so somber and so black and white in terms of moral issues and ethical questions, you need to somehow go further or deeper, don't you? And I don't think the film really does that. I think it sort of coasts on it, on its premise, on the basic setup of uncle and nephew bonding. What do you think of that?
I think you hit the nail right on the head, which brings me to, and which is kind of related to the blah, blah, blah thing, is the title, which... It's again, the kid talking about how really life is about talking yourself into things or going along. Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. When that came up in the movie, I thought, really, that's the title you were going to pick for the whole thing? I was really surprised. Again, it was one of those things, again, where you drop out of the movie to think, wait, that kind of clunked right there.
That's a wonderful observation. I understand the title. And when you watch the film in context, it makes sense. But from a marketing perspective, just from a common sense perspective, it's just really a clunky title. It just doesn't quite give me a sense of the picture. And it seems kind of facile. It just seems sort of precious, if you will. And again, a film that takes itself so seriously beyond the degree to which it should take itself seriously. I just think that the film is kind of self-absorbed that way. And I don't think there are enough points of connection where the viewer can be pulled in, with the uncle being just too naive in his initial assumptions and the way he handles it, with the kid being almost insufferable at certain points with some of the games he plays. There are things that actually pull me away from the film. And that's maybe, ironically, this is my confession, why I wanted to learn more about the sister and her troubled relationship with her partner, you know, who's got bipolar issues or however you want to, you know, describe this. But that's an interesting scenario, their relationship. But it's handled in a sort of touch and go way in the film. And maybe I wanted more of that just to get away from the uncle and nephew for a while. How'd you respond to that?
I think we're in agreement about this movie. I want to mention though that the director says that the heart of this movie is giving the kid a bath. In his own words, that's at the core, all the intimacy, all the interpersonal richness that can happen in this very intimate space. Very small. Okay. But to me, I didn't really find that the bathtub scene was really all that poignant. I didn't realize that was the high point until I read that quote.
I still don't see it as the high point. I mean, I'm all for taking baths. I mean, you know, but the thing is that, you know, I don't really dramatically see that in watching the film itself. I can believe it based on the director's quote, but watching the film, that didn't naturally occur to me. So you and I share that as well.
Now, we've talked a lot about how much we didn't like things about the movie, but how about some strengths in terms of any Oscar nods? Because I would think that Joaquin Phoenix and Gabby Hoffman and this young man, Woody Norman, would all be possible acting nods. Anything else? And do you agree with those?
No, I agree with those. It's a well-acted film. And because it's such a tight character study, all three of those performances would merit that kind of attention. But what strikes me as sort of funny about it is that might be the only nominations or the only awards I would consider there, because I don't think the film otherwise would really merit much. But you got to acknowledge strong acting. So sure, I would give the nominations there. But beyond that, for the reasons we've detailed, I don't think it's a particularly strong film.
Well, neither the Spider-Man movie nor the Come On, Come On seem to have even garnered any Golden Globes, which is sometimes the first indication of what's going to be nominated. So we'll see what happens. So that brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to check out our other podcasts. at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com and also under Dragon Digital Radio on Spotify and Pandora. And we'll see you next time at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.